Author of the Week with Jessica Burtis, Alex Lefchuk, and of course, another sensationally talented purveyor of perfect prose.
But who's the author?
Let's find out.
Can it really be a year ago since Shapers of Worlds Volume 1 was released? Astonishingly, yes. And we're already now into Shapers of Worlds Volume 2. What are Shapers of Worlds, you may well say? Well, if I said the wonderful, magical words Edwin Willits, you'd probably sort of say, is that fabulous Saskatchewan-based author who has contributed on an annual basis since 2019, pre-pandemic, 2020, at the height of the pandemic, and now here he is back again in 2021. Yes, it is, and we're delighted to welcome the aforementioned Edwin Willits back to the programme from Saskatchewan. How are you, Edwin?
I'm doing fine. Thanks for having me back.
Oh, it was great to connect with your good self. Where does the time go? I mean, it seems like literally only yesterday. I think it was September 2020 when we last actually spoke.
That is probably right.
The first anthology was awesome. It was tremendous. It was more than an anthology, but in fact, there's an interesting concept that you've actually put together in terms of a collection of curiosities, a collection of antiquities and so on. But here we are, as I say, in the second edited edition of Shapers of Worlds. This time it's all come around from contributors to your podcast, of course.
Same as the first one. The first one was the first year of the podcast, and these contributors this year were the second year of the podcast. And in many ways, this is a bigger and better, I shouldn't say better, but a bigger anthology. The first one had 18 stories, 9 were originals and 9 were reprints. This time I have 18 original stories and only 6 reprints. So the resulting book, this is the hardcover here, is quite thick. It's 540 pages. So the other one is 300 and some. So it was a substantially larger volume this time around.
It certainly sort of works. It's one of the reasons why I must admit I've actually gone for the electronic version from that point of view, but it's all there and sorted through. But again, just reading through the delights you've actually got there from the opening by Kelly Armstrong and Shadow Sight, it really opens up a whole range of things. And that's what I wanted to talk about, this whole notion of the days of the 16th centuries and the 16th century and the Cabinet of Curiosities. Would you like to just expand a little bit on that whole concept?
Well, I was looking for a good metaphor for what this is, and I hit on that. I've always heard about Cabinets of Curiosities, and it's a cool title, right? Mm-hmm. And it was basically collectors. And at the time, they didn't necessarily collect in the way we would do it now. It might just be things that interested them. It could be a variety of things. It could be antiquities. It could be books. It could be art, little sculptures, fossils, whatever. And that seemed like a very good metaphor for it. And by the way, at the time, cabinets didn't mean like a kitchen cabinet. It could mean an entire room. So they could be substantial collections. They were kind of the precursors to museums. And that was a good metaphor for this because the only theme is that all of these authors were guests on my podcast, The World Shapers. And as a result, it is an eclectic mixture of tales, everything from far future science fiction to present day supernatural fiction to straight ahead fantasy to alternate history. If you don't like one story, there's another one coming along, which is going to be quite different.
It is great. I mean, I remember, so we were talking last time about, one of your novels, and you had a sort of subtext, the whole notion of werewolves and vampires and peasants. Oh, my. I actually misread that. For some reason, I actually thought you said pheasants. And I thought, actually, that would be an even worse title for the book, basically. Although, having said that, vampires and werewolves and pheasants, oh, my, would be quite good from that sort of point of view. But no, I think it was peasants. So that was another time. Prestigiousness and obviously prolific aspects of writing, no bounds. I mean, has the pandemic been good for you from that point of view? I mean, clearly, now, of course, we're faced with the Omicron version that could be sort of just about to emerge from South Africa and other areas, etc. So maybe, we're still looking at mutations coming through. But from your own experiential perspective, and again, I know we discussed this back in 2020 about how it can open up things like we're doing now, which is living the science fiction dream. But again, now we're kind of over the first hurdle into whatever new normal this happens to be. Has it helped the creative process?
I think it bothered me more than I thought it did. I mean, I work from home anyway, right? Yet I found that being stuck at home quite a bit when, you know, I couldn't go to a coffee shop or somewhere like that to work, which has typically been my more typical modus operandi, I found it actually harder to be productive sometimes sitting here at home than if I could go out. So I think it did actually impact. I know the novel that I was writing over the last several months, which will be out next year from Daw Books, called The Tangled Stars, it seemed to take me a lot longer than I'm accustomed to novels taking me to write. And I think part of that was definitely, it's not so much the virus or, you know, per se, but it's kind of that overweening pressure of all the news and wondering what, you know, what strange thing the government's going to do next and all that kind of stuff. So I've always kind of pushed back at the idea that writers should be able to write no matter what's going on in the world, because obviously, you know, through history, there have been horrible things happening around people, much worse than, I mean, people were producing art and music and literature when the bubonic plague was ravaging Europe. But I think it did affect me a little bit.
I was particularly interested in terms of how crowdfunding was utilized to actually put the package together, certainly for Shapers of Worlds. And that's something, again, which initially I was thinking a few weeks ago, maybe the crowdfunding peak has actually passed, but is that a wonderful way of democratically coordinating art? I mean, you mentioned obviously in the plague and various other things. Of course, we've always had patrons of the arts. We'd have the Medici family. We'd have the Renaissance painters who would effectively be supported by nominated mentors or people who had actually chosen them. Is crowdfunding the kind of democratic equivalent for the 21st century?
I think it certainly opens up possibilities for people to produce things they would not otherwise be able to produce. And you're drawing funds from people who really want to see that thing made. So you're not making something and then trying to sell it. Well, I'm trying to sell the book too, obviously, but for the creative part of it, the crowdfunding allowed me, it's the only way I could have done it, because I was only interested in doing with these authors, and they would only have been interested, most of them I would think, in doing it if I could pay a reasonable per word payment. So the only way I could do that was kickstarting, because it required a fairly substantial upfront cost, because I wanted to pay 10 cents a word Canadian for the new fiction. It worked, but it never would have happened without crowdsourcing. I don't think I would have been willing to plunge $15,000 of my own money in to make sure that I could pay the authors with no guarantee that I would ever make that back in sales. It certainly has opened up a new way for creators to create things they otherwise would not have been able to.
As we frequently said, the anthology has a long and revered history going back to Edgar Allan Poe and beyond in many ways, in terms of actually putting together collections and collations of short stories and so on. We're delighted to welcome one of the ACE graduates, of course, from North Carolina, and indeed somebody who did an exchange at the University of Lincoln. That's Jessica Burtis, back in North Carolina now. Home, of course, as we've said frequently, of boiled peanuts and sweet tea. Jessica, welcome aboard. Any questions you'd like to put to Edward at the moment?
Yeah, there's so many. The book cover, I'm such a sucker for like book covers that have planets on them. And so I was like, this is perfect. So I have so many questions, but I have to ask, have you always been interested in sci-fi and science fiction books?
Yes, I had two older brothers who read science fiction. And so it was around the house. And I can remember reading it very, very early. And it must have been early, because the first complete short story I wrote, I was 11 years old. And its title was Castor Glass Hypership Test Pilot. So you can tell that I had been heavily influenced already in the first decade of my life. And I just went on from there. And everything that I attempted to write, and I wrote three novels in high school, and you know, other short stories and all kinds of stuff, it always tended toward science fiction and fantasy. I'm pretty I'm a universalist when it comes to that. I'll write both.
I saw in the anthology that the stories can kind of take place anywhere. They can be in the future, on Earth, or in other worlds. So do you usually prefer to write stories in the futuristic Earth, or do you prefer to write them in outer space and make up your whole new world?
My stories have varied, again, from traditional fantasy and completely made up worlds. I also have a young adult fantasy series called The Shards of Excalibur with Arthurian elements, but it's set in the modern day. So it's two modern day teenagers. And then some of my fiction is far future space opera, like my upcoming novel, The Tangled Stars. So again, I'm pretty willing to go wherever the story idea takes me. And in some cases, I have a novel called The City Born from Daw, which is science fiction, but I also offered a completely fantasy version of basically the same setup. It would have played out differently in many ways, but it was the same basic idea of this city over a gorge that had filled up with the garbage produced by the city over the years, and there were people scavenging in the garbage. That basic idea, I went with the science fiction direction, but I also had a fantasy version of it in my head. So I'll do either.
We also talked about how you were quite impressed with the kind of cyclical nature of how you could actually be the commissioner of a reprint of Joe Haldeman, etc. In the latest collection of authors, were there any others who you kind of had read as a youth yourself, or you thought actually this is quite special?
I think most of these are more people that I read as an adult. I don't think there's anybody here that went back as far as when I was a kid. But there were certainly names that I was particularly happy to have in here. One of those was Garth Nix, a huge best-selling author from Australia. I met him once at a science fiction or fantasy convention, World Fantasy Convention in Toronto, I think. And then he was very generous and was a guest. And then he had a new story for me. So he was one of the ones that I was really happy to get in here. I guess some of the others that made an impression on me as well. Hambley, who's been writing for a very, very long time. And she actually gave me one of her older stories, which I just loved. So there's always some of that. And none of these I'm getting quite old, so none of them go back to when I was a kid. But a lot of them are authors that I have read just for pleasure. And the fact that I then had an opportunity to publish either a new story or a reprint of theirs, it makes me very happy.
Of course, since last we spoke, about a year ago, you've been elected to the board of directors of SaskBook, Saskatchewan's provincial creative industry association for book publishers, which again, was that always part of the grand dream?
I never had a grand dream. I started Shadowpaw Press, which has published the two anthologies, mainly for two projects I wanted to do right away. The first one was my own collection of short fiction. I don't write a lot of short fiction, so it's taken me 40 years to have enough short fiction to put into a collection. But I brought that out first. And then the other thing I always wanted to bring out was my grandfather-in-law's First World War memoirs, which were around the house. He wrote them late in life, and he had served as a truck driver and then as a navigator in the Royal Air Force on a Handley Page bomber. In the First World War. And then he was shot down and he finished the war in a prisoner of war camp. So he had written this short collection of memoirs, and I managed to get that out in time for for Armistice Day in 2018. So for the 100th anniversary of Armistice, I managed to get that out, which got it some nice attention. I had those two projects in mind, but then I had Shadowpaw Press, and I have a bunch of books that I've killed a lot of publishers. It's not my fault, but several of them have gone by the wayside over the years, which means the books have come back to me. So I wanted to bring some of those out through Shadowpaw Press. And then when the anthology came along, it was an opportunity to move away from, this is sort of self-publishing, but at the same time, I want Shadowpaw Press to publish other authors. And I'm working on that goal now. But originally, I'm not sure I had that goal. It was just a way to get these first two things out there and get them a little more attention. And then I've discovered I really enjoy putting out books. I love the fact that I have this lovely hardcover of a book that I made happen. I mean, that just makes me feel good. And so I do hope to continue to expand Shadowpaw Press as much as I can, with the understanding that it's just me and the cat after whom it's named, and he's no help at all. So.
Well, maybe not that you understand, but maybe on some deeply subconscious, subliminal level, he's actually guiding you in terms of the creative authors to actually seek out.
I don't think so.
Honestly, you Canadians, you're so cynical at times. It's unbelievable. Jessica, back to you.
So what are some of your favorite sci-fi novels that you've read growing up? You said there were a lot. So what are your favorites that kind of like endured in your mind today?
There's two authors that undoubtedly had the most influence on me. One of them was Robert A. Heinlein. I read everything I could get my hands on, all his so-called juveniles, which would be YA, they'd call them now, because the kids are usually teenagers. Those made a huge impact. And I read all his adult books, too. Up to a point, I started to lose him after Time Enough for Love. No, Time Enough, no, Stranger in a Strange Land was a little too weird for me at the time when I was a kid. But I really liked all of his short stories in the juvenile stuff. I read a lot of short stories at the time as well. And then Andre Norton was the other one that was a big influence on me. And you can really see her influence in Star Song, which is the image behind you there, the cover from Star Song, with these kind of space-going families. That's very much an Andre Norton thing, Moon of Three Rings and some of those. So I think those two are probably my biggest influences. Although one of the first ones I remember is actually Robert Silverberg, who's still around, still writing, because he wrote a novel when he was 18 called Revolt on Alpha C. And that one made an impression on me as well. It may be the first, it was a very short book. I have a copy of it here somewhere. Not handy. It may be the first science fiction novel I read. So I've always enjoyed his as well. So I go back to the, and then Isaac Asimov and the robot novels. I go back to the Arthur C. Clarke, Robert Heinlein, and Isaac Asimov era when they were the big three in science fiction.
One of the things that's obviously changed probably with the advent in the 60s of Ursula K. Le Guin, if you exclude Mary Shelley, who wrote the first arguable science fiction novel back in in the 19th century, about 1815 and so on and so forth. Yeah, exactly. It is, of course, the sort of way in which genders are bouncing. I mean, thankfully, I think we've moved on since James Tiptree Jr. had to effectively sort of write under, or DC Fontana had to use masculine names. Do you feel that science fiction is catching up with the rest of the world when it comes to gender balances? Because it's been a bit of an accusation that's been leveled at us sometimes, that actually it's been more of a kind of boys' toys, male fantasy genre than perhaps it deserves to be.
Yeah, and I don't actually think that's a, as from people who haven't paid that much attention, or they've come along in later times and they're putting their own view on it. There's in fact, there's a whole anthology put out by, I think Christine Catherine Roche directed, edited it. From all these wonderful women authors who were writing in the 60s and 70s and 80s. I mean, and on the editorial side, I would venture to say that for a long time, there's been more women editors than there have been men. Certainly, you know, I'm published by Daw Books. Betsy Wolheim and Sheila Gilbert took that over in the 1980s. And then most of the editors I've ever submitted to have been women. So I've never seen that myself from my perspective on it. I seem to certainly 50-50, and I would actually think I probably dealt with more women in the field than I have men.
Although I suppose these days, Edward, when we're told there are 63 different genders, you don't quite know where you're going to go in terms of various other issues. But there we are.
That's a very science fictional thing too, you know, of having that concept.
Yeah. Jessica, of course, the reason I'm talking about writing is she's in the process of writing her great American novel. You know, it's there, it's going to happen. I think it's a Romans Built, etc. Deep dive into Irish culture, deep dive into North Carolina culture. Any advice for young writers in terms of developing their style and their voice in many ways?
I only have two pieces of advice for writers, and I work a lot with young writers. I've been writer in residence at the Regina and Saskatoon Public Libraries, and I've been in schools and things like that. And I don't know that it's very helpful advice. It's read and write. That's kind of it. You got to read the kind of stuff that you want to write to see how authors deal with the problems that arise in whatever that genre is, because we're all trying to face the same issues when we're writing a novel. If it's science fiction, there's often how do you get across the information of how the world is different, and how do you make that seem believable, and how do you not, you know, do something really stupid like having sound in outer space or something like that, unless you're a movie. And then the writing, the only way you learn to write is by writing and by trying to make each thing you write better than the last thing you wrote. And that's the advice. Read and write, and do the best you can. And learn. Be willing to accept criticism. Be willing to if you show it to somebody who is perhaps more advanced in the field, don't get your back up because they are saying ways that it might be better. I also do a lot of editing. And just recently, I edited a novel for somebody, and he was very, very thankful and, you know, took all the advice and said, oh yeah, that's right, I understand that. But a while ago I did one for somebody else, and he was so horrified by the fact that I had suggested that perhaps a death scene went on a little too long and was getting a little too Shakespearean, and I made some sort of light joke to that effect, and he was so horrified that I joked about his heartfelt death scene, that he was just wouldn't have anything to do. I was anonymous for all of this, so he doesn't know I was his editor. He wouldn't have anything more to do with me as an editor. So I think you have to be willing to not be so invested in your own words that you're unwilling to make changes for the better. But again, it is your story. So ultimately you do have to decide if you agree with those comments or not, but don't get upset because somebody makes those comments.
Yes, the ego can indeed be a fragile thing.
You need to have a thick skin. I'm one of the authors who normally does read my reviews, but there is one I haven't because it was so horrible. I didn't subject myself to it, but you just have to let that stuff roll off your back.
Thank you.
We know this from a weekly podcast we do called Resonance Rewind, where occasionally we have curmudgeonly members of the panel who will actually sort of downgrade something and even criticize something like Joe 90 from Gerry Anderson. I still don't understand why Robin Pierce took that line, but never mind. That's by the by. We talked about, obviously, the growth of the anthology, but of course, Rod Serling, known for, of course, the anthology notion of the Twilight Zone, the Outer Limits, of course, they're all anthology series. Do you feel as though, in many ways, both for the first and second volume of World Shapers, there's a kind of cinematic edge or a televisual edge that actually there should really, I mean, now Canada is hosting so much fabulous television, why not actually have a Shapers of Worlds series?
Well, that would be grand. Although, of course, it would have to be negotiated with the actual authors and not with me. So I don't know. They're so different. They're so very different. I think authors, viewers might get a bit of a whiplash if they're, you know, first week they are seeing something that was adapted from Shadow Sight, which is kind of a frontier women with special powers story, which are used for vengeance, basically. And then the next week you're doing like my story, which comes from my next year's novel, which has a talking cat and is set on the moon. I mean, I think perhaps because it is a cabinet of curiosities, it might be a little too eclectic to work well in a TV series.
I don't know.
There have been a couple like Amazing Stories when it was back in the 80s. And I think they're rebooting it or have rebooted it. Certainly has stories all over the place, but on the other hand, at least the original one didn't last very long either, even with Steven Spielberg behind it.
And of course, there's the Ray Bradbury Theater. We've had One Step Beyond. We've had, of course, the Rod Serling Night Gallery, Twilight Zone, which still seems to obviously resonate in various incarnations. I think it's in its third incarnation latterly, and the Outer Limits. Jessica, back to yourself. Any other thoughts you'd like to raise?
I'm really curious about how you go about world building, because I know it's so important, especially in sci-fi. So how do you kind of go about
world shaping?
How do you go about making this whole world in the future or in space that's completely unique?
It's almost a muscle that you exercise over time, I think. In the podcast, my most recent guest was Mercedes Lackey, who's the latest grandmaster for SIFWA, the Science Fiction Fantasy Writers of America. And she actually pegged down something that I do when I'm talking about writing that I didn't realize I had gotten it from Theodore Sturgeon, I believe. And it's ask the next question. So you start with a basic premise. It usually starts with what if is your first question. What if a cat had a quantum AI embedded in its brain so that it could talk? Then you ask the next question, well, what would that mean? What kind of society, first of all, could produce that? What would that mean for pet owners? What would that mean for the cat food industry? You know, you're just asking a series of questions and building out from that. With science fiction, you want to try to ensure that your answers at least bear some vague resemblance to how we understand the universe actually works. And if it's a fantasy story, you at least want to make sure that whatever magical things you put in there all hang together logically and all make sense together. So it's I always think of it as self-interrogation and just trying to imagine step by step, spreading out from your initial idea, what the rest of the society works like. And sometimes you just throw stuff in because it's cool. I think I'll have two moons in the sky instead of just one, or whatever.
Have you ever created a world that you really would just, or a future that you would just love to live in?
They're usually pretty awful because that's where the best stories happen. There's one where I destroyed pretty much the entire population of the earth by a plague. So, you know, I don't really want to live in that one.
Maybe not.
Yeah. Was it called COVID by any chance, or indeed Omicron? Just a thought.
Oh, Omicron sounds like a science fiction character, a science fiction villain, actually.
Well, or indeed a couple of Star Trek planets. You got Omicron SETI 3 the connection with this side of paradise. And of course, Khan, I think, was on Omicron SETI 4, which is all very strange and bizarre. You mentioned, Edwards, that Mercedes Lackey was your most recent guest in terms of your own podcast, which we are happy to promote in terms of that's really what served as the basis for the World Shaper series. So, that's only 3 more episodes away from the magic 100. So do we get any teasers as yet in terms of who you actually have in mind for the 100th episode of your podcast series, The World Shapers?
I haven't even thought about it as a special episode, but I already have 3 lined up, I think, that will take me to that. I've got, I do. James Kennedy will be the next one. And then I've got, what's his name?
That's always good. It's always good. I mean, it's the famous cat. What's his name, yeah. Etc. Some people refer to him as Schrodinger, perhaps, but I don't know. What the heck?
I think the 100th is going to end up being Michael Brent Collins at the moment, who's a Dragon Award winner and quite prolific himself. I think that's the way it's going to work out, and then we'll see after that.
Yeah. Well, we like to celebrate, I think, as I did last year with respect to your 4th of September.
Mark Leslie LaFavre. That's the one I forgot. Mark Leslie LaFavre is the one I forgot.
Excellent. Just make sure that's sort of through there. This, out of interest, we can welcome you, actually, Edwards, to the fact that this is podcast number 4,771, which is always a very magic number. So 4,771 for our sort of regular podcast listeners, as opposed to Siren Radio listeners, in case I don't know where we are with respect to that. But there we are. A significant number, I'm sure you'll appreciate.
I suspect you do it more often than once every 2 weeks. That's why mine takes a long time to go up.
Yeah, well, you know, we just we sort of work through that. Let's talk about your website, because there's something which comes in terms of the website, which I thought was just so charming. It needs to be flagged up, and people should visit edwardwillits.com now just to actually catch hold of a little musical theatre from the Willett family, posted 7 months ago. Taking me 2 minutes to actually read. Share with us what's happening with respect to a little musical theatre from the Willett family.
Well, all of us are musical, and I have been involved for a long time with Vagina Lyric Musical Theater. And because we couldn't do a physical show last winter, they did an online show. And so my wife and I did Sue Me from Guys and Dolls. My daughter, Alice, who's at the University of Toronto, did Tonight's the Night from, I forgot the name of the musical. And then I did Maria from The Sound of Music. How do you solve a problem like Maria? All 4 nuns parts. And I sang each one separately, and then I was digitally combined in front of a green screen so that there's 4 of me dressed vaguely as nuns, because what it really is a white t-shirt with a black t-shirt over top of it. singing Maria, all 4 parts, and reacting to myself in each direction as I do so. So there's a bit of my singing on there.
This is clearly the genius at work that effectively was responsible for Tatiana Maslowy being so inspired by you when you were her tutor when she was a child, basically, you know. So obviously her career, which has gone to Orphan Black, to the Marvel Universe and She-Hulk, etc., Tatiana's got you to thank for it, and of course channeling your inner Julie Andrews.
Well, I knew her and I did direct her in one show, but I don't think I was her major inspiration. Last time I met her, she gave me a hug. So there's that. So at least she remembers who I am. So.
Well, there you go. Exactly. Jessica, any final thoughts from yourself?
Do you have anything in the works right now coming up, or are you kind of just enjoying the holiday season coming up?
Well, I've got a lot of publishing things I'm working on, and I'm just waiting for The Tangled Stars, my next novel from Daw Books, which is a comic space opera. It's the one that has the talking cat in it. He ends up as the Starship Captain at one point. I'm waiting for that to come back from Sheila Gilbert at Daw for editorial revisions. So that'll be the next big thing I expect to work on. And I'll be writing something new, but I'm not quite decided what it will be yet. I have several possibilities.
I still like the notion of Cabinet of Curiosities. I mean, I think that's got to be something which you could actually use as another sort of series if you ever sort of feel you want to sort of diversify from Shapers of Worlds. I mean, that would work on so many ways. I also just realized, actually, Edward, that although you've been on the show, this is your third appearance, it's the first time it has been a genuine appearance. I know it's radio for the listener, that makes no difference, the theater of the mind, but we've actually had our cameras on. So that's wonderful. It's great. We'll be able to see each other. Marvelous. It's
always nice to see people and not just hear voices. And it also helps knowing when people have stopped talking so that it's your turn to talk.
Yeah, I mean, I've often said we should just go back to the old traditional radio days of saying over at the end of every sort of sentence. Over. There you go. We've got those two standard questions, though, which we are going to use as a matter of course, apart from, of course, noting the fact that if you want to have a magical entree into science fiction, fantasy, nonfiction, columns about writing, music, and indeed general wonderment, presumably edwardwillett.com is the best place to go to?
Yeah, I think so. It's two T's on Willett, edwardwillett.com.
And I've also got to ask the question, I mean, it was a matter of 48 hours ago that obviously Jessica was partying on down like there's no tomorrow with Thanksgiving and all that wonderful ways of actually saying, yay, bring out the turkey, the cranberry sauce, the sweet tea and so on. North of the border, does it mean anything to you at all? Or is it just a case of those crazy people down south? What are they getting up to?
Well, of course, Canadian Thanksgiving is in October, because by the time you get to November, it's a little late for a harvest festival in most of Canada. We had a blizzard like 2 weeks ago. So, but one thing that has gone everywhere is Black Friday. So there are Black Friday sales everywhere, even though there's no holiday attached with it here. So there are Black Friday sales all across Canada. And I know they're in the UK too. So.
And indeed across the globe, it would seem, together with Storm Arwen, which is massively affecting the British Isles, even as I speak, you know, so many ways. But, you know, that's life. The two questions that we wrap up with remain the same. Jessica, would you like to ask question number one?
Yes, Edward, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us today?
I have had a very interesting Zoomer with you today. Not just reasonably, very.
Excellent. And the next critical question then, Edward, is will you be kind enough to return? Will you come back? I mean, this has obviously got to be the annual Edward Willett Midweek Drive appearance. I mean, I'd like to make it more frequent, I think. Will you come back before, let's say, October 2022?
Happy to do so, although I will have Shapers of Worlds Volume 3 next year, I hope. I'll be kickstarting that in March, I think. So,
Edward Willett, and of course, the Shapers of Worlds guru and all sorts of other bits and pieces. Be well, be happy, be safe, and keep on writing.
I will.
Well, it was back in the day that Squeeze, I believe, had a hit with Cool for Cats, and maybe they were actually prescient and well ahead of their times, because just as Top Cat, of course, and of course those Siamese cats proved that it could be wonderful to be more cat-like, maybe, just maybe, we can actually learn from our feline friends. Certainly this is all part of the great cat census that is clearly something you may not have been aware of that took place earlier this year from the Republic of Cats. And to talk about the fascinating world of the great cat census, we're delighted to welcome two fabulous individuals. First of all, the general manager of Republic of Cats, that's Cat Knocker. How are you, Cat?
I'm great. Thanks for having us, Alex.
Excellent stuff. And we've also got that awesomely talented television presenter extraordinaire, top writer and top journalist. It's Anna Richardson. How are you, Anna?
Oh, Alex, I love you for that. Hello.
Always great to connect with your good self. Now, Anna, were you surprised by these findings, which kind of tend to suggest that cats, like most mammalian life forms, like to be independent, but they like their affection as well?
Do you know what? I was not surprised by this. I'm going to declare an interest, Alex. I am obsessed with cats. So any survey that comes out, particularly this one from the Republic of Cats, I am well in. I am well in. So basically, this survey is saying that we can learn a thing or two from our feline friends if we want to be happier and healthier as a human being. And 82% of humans surveyed said they admired how independent cats are. So that ability to just shrug off the negativity and walk away as if nothing has happened. Also, the fact that cats are hardwired to walk away from any situation that doesn't give them pleasure or interest them. I mean, how amazing is that? As a human, to be able to turn around and go, no, I'm not interested in this. It doesn't bring me pleasure. So thank you, but I'm going to politely decline. So I found this survey really, really insightful.
It's a choice factor. Although, are we saying that cats are secret hedonists, that they're actually all Epicureans in philosophical times, and they just can't be bothered with wasting any kind of notion on stoicism? But that's by the by. Cat, let's turn to your good self. From your own perspective as general manager of Republic of Cats, when you put the survey together, again, were you particularly interested in any of the sort of major findings such as Anna's referred to?
Yeah, from our perspective, we really wanted to dig in actually to that special cat and owner or cat human experience that happens behind closed doors. At Republic of Cats, we're all about understanding each cat as an individual, which we use to make a one box nutrition that arrives to your door every month. So we're all about understanding cats as an individual from the start. But actually, what really came through was how we just delight in some of these cat personalities and how recognizable they are. Not everyone's cat is the same, of course, but we can definitely see little glimmers of these different personality snippets between the cats that we have in our lives. Absolutely love the celebration of cats as the imperious one, for example, who might not turn up to greet your friends at the door, but might be waiting for you when you get home. You just never quite know what they're going to be up to, whether they're going to be doing what you think they would be or just what they want to do, which is quite frankly what they do most of the time, for example.
I was certainly going to say, I mean, back with Anna again, in terms of the definitions that we've got here, I mean, the imperious one you've already mentioned, the Pilates puss, the catnap, the constant cuddler. I mean, it's almost like definitions of people you might well have interviewed, Anna, especially the declutter.
That's a really, really good point. Thinking about it, actually, I mean, you know, the two shows that I've been doing for the last year, so Changing Rooms and obviously Naked Attraction, you could definitely apply both of those shows to some of these cats. But, you know, the constant cuddler, on a serious point, you know, for now, think about lockdown and how isolated people have been. We've all really missed that touch, and particularly the human touch. But if you are isolated, if you are on your own, the research has shown that having an animal, particularly a cat with you, having that ability to be able to stroke your cat shows that it reduces your blood pressure, it reduces your stress hormone, cortisol, and it also increases the pleasure hormone, oxytocin. So on a serious note, it really does bring enormous benefits to have a cat and to sit and to stroke and cuddle it. And that goes both ways. The cat releases those pleasure hormones as well. So it really is a very beneficial relationship for both.
And you just don't get that kind of satisfaction with a stick insect or a goldfish, do you really? It's just it's got to be the same, really. I mean, you can communicate with them, but also their lifespan isn't quite as large as that. I mean, Kat, how would you define yourself? Are you an imperious one? Are you a Pilates puss?
I think I'd say I'm a declutterer. Constantly trying to manage life out of a small flat needs an element of that cat-like ability to just discard belongings and actually not take life too seriously and attach too much to the things you have around you. Admittedly, I'm not smashing vases or pushing paperwork off tables, which is maybe the cat method, but I definitely take a lot of inspiration from that.
And in terms of adapting things for our own human Homo sapiens-based lifestyle, Anna, I mean, the catnap, I would have thought, is essential for all media souls to actually sort of get that rest before you're actually faced with yet another round of interviews.
Ah, yeah, no, that's a very, very good point. You're right that, you know, the research shows that cats incredibly can sleep between 10 to 13 hours a day. And again, they're genetically hardwired to do that. But the research is showing that 3/4 of us as humans are not getting the requisite sleep that we need. So again, I think the focus needs to be on our health and well-being and really focusing on being able to relax and get some proper sleep post-lockdown.
7 to 9 hours of sleep, apparently, is the general recommendation. I don't think that tends to vary. I do like the notion of putting in a mad mini marathon, though, and tearing around with a session of Zoomies. Now, that presumably means not doing what we're doing now, having a session via Zoom, but actually Zooming around.
The original Zoom, I think.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense, really. Although, for me, that's just a nice lolly back in the 1960s. You're far too young to remember.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, yeah, that's there you go.
celebrating that burst of energy and being a bit silly. I think that's quite inspiring in cats. Yeah.
So looking onwards to nutrition, I mean, that's the other thing. Obviously, we need our sleep. We also need to ensure that we take in good material to ourselves. I mean, that's good, presumably, for cats and humans.
Oh, 100%. And I think we all know ourselves how different we can feel when we feed ourselves the right nutrition. And we knew that was definitely the case for cats. And when we started Republic of Cats, it was with that in mind that the power of tailored nutrition could bring to cats around the UK. And so we created a concept where we're able to ask you or your listeners some questions about their cat, which enables us to then design a feeding plan together that takes all of their nutritional needs into account. and feed them as the individual that they are. Maybe that you want to work on something like reducing hairballs. It might be that you want a glossier coat, or even a less smelly poo in the litter tray. And we can tailor the ingredients that go into their box just for them. It's brilliant to hear back from owners about the difference it's made to their cat.
You see, clearly our Prime Minister was all wrong when he was talking about Peppa Pig, etc. He should have actually been talking about Republic of Cats to actually identify the whole new world that you've actually got there. In fact, probably cats would do a better job running the country, but that's another line for another day. And we can talk about that at length. Presumably, republicofcats.com, is that the best place to go to, Anna, to find out further details about the survey and indeed the findings?
Absolutely, www.republicofcats.com. And let's face it, Alex, who doesn't want to reduce their hairball?
Well, there you go. I mean, that is probably one of the best outros we've ever had for quite some time. But I'll finish with those two classic consumer survey ones, basically. First of all, Anna Richardson, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today? Has it been good for you?
It's been amazing. Thank you.
Excellent. This is good. Is it a smiley face from yourself as well, Kat?
Yeah, definitely. Wonderful talking with you, Alex.
Excellent. So the next critical question is, can we look forward to featuring you again in the not too distant future? Will you both return with more cat news and beyond?
I'd love to.
100%.
The Indians send signals from the rocks above the pass. The cowboys take position in the bushes and the grass. The score is with the corporal, she is tied against the tree. She doesn't mind the language, it's the beating she don't need. She lets loose all the horses when the corporal is asleep. And he wakes to find the fire's dead and arrows in his axe. And Davy Crockett rides around and says it's cool for cats, it's cool for cats. The Sweeney's doing 90 cause they've got nowhere to go. They get a gang of villains in a shed up at Heathrow. They're counting out the fivers when the handcuffs lock again. In and out of Wandsworth with the numbers on their names. It's funny how the missus always looks a bleeding sane. And meanwhile at the station there's a couple of likely lads who swear like as your father and they're very cool for cats, they're cool for cats. Change the mood a little, I've been posing down the pub. I'm seeing my reflection, I'm looking slightly rough. I fancy this, I fancy that, I wanna be so fresh. I'll give a little muscle and I'll spend a little cash. But all I get is bitter and a nasty little rash. And by the time I'm sober, I've forgotten what I've had. And everybody tells me that it's cool to be a cat, cool for cats. Questions that she hangs onto the wall. I kiss her for the first time and then I take her home. I'm invited in for coffee and I give the dog a bone. She likes to go to discos but she's never on her own. I said I'll see you later and I'll give her some old chat. But it's not like they on the TV when it's cool for cats, it's cool for cats.
clearly there are issues with respect to sustainability and the fishing industry and a whole variety of other aspects as well. But maybe, just maybe, another form of cod can actually be helping this in a variety of ways. We'll find out how over the next few moments, because we're delighted to welcome two fabulous individuals to actually talk about the state of marine stocks in the North Sea, in particular relating to cod. First of all, we have the wonderful founder of Tomola Amola Consulting, of course. It's marine biologist Tom Pickerel. How are you, Tom?
I'm great, thank you. Good morning.
Excellent. Great to connect with you, good self. And also from another form of COD, in fact, specifically Call of Duty, from online platform, Stakester, we have the fabulous Chief Executive Officer, Tom Ferry. How are you, Tom?
I'm great, Alex. Thanks for having me on.
Marvellous. Let's turn to our marine biologist first from this point of view. We hear all sorts of challenges with respect to fish in the North Sea, particularly with respect to cod and how it can be replenished and so on. How serious is this situation to start off with?
Yeah, it is serious. It's been an up and down journey. Cod in the North Sea were really badly overfished in the late 90s into the 2000s. And actually, the population fell to its lowest level recorded in 2005. And an emergency plan was put in place to rebuild it and help stabilize the population. And that worked. So much so that in 2017, the fishery was actually awarded Marine Stewardship Council certification for being sustainably managed. And it reached its highest stock levels since 1982. So, you know, everyone was delighted by this. But then the stock decreased year on year, and the certification was suspended in 2019. So that's a real negative. And we're not entirely clear why this is. We think it's a variety of factors, such as warming waters driven by climate change, a decline in the survival of the older fish and fewer younger fish joining the fishery. But also the quotas, this is the amount you can actually fish, were set above the scientific advice in 2019 and 2020. And that needs to stop if we're going to actually stabilize and regrow this enigmatic stock.
Because as you rightly said, Tom, I mean, the fact that we were able to restore reasonable levels proves that it can be done. The cod recovery plan in the early 2000s effectively helped to restore stocks to sustainable levels, again, through limits on fishing days, decommissioning of boats and so on. So it would seem to be a bit of a no-brainer that surely we need to actually employ those things again, unless, you know, we're going to have no cod at all.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the North Sea cod fishery could really suffer if we don't do that. We're very fortunate because, obviously, as a nation who loves cod, we have plentiful supplies of cod that we import from the Arctic waters of the Barents Sea in Iceland. And that's where the vast majority of cod that we eat in the UK comes from. But the important thing here is, you know, this is a very important fishery for UK communities, fishing communities. So there is there's a wider issue here, not just about the supply, but also the fact of the healthy ecosystem, but also healthy communities.
And let's move now to Thomas Ferry from the point of view of Stakester. Stakester, obviously, a wonderful online platform to connect with in all sorts of ways. But Tom, just for the benefit of the listener who might think, but apart from Call of Duty and other sort of forms of COD, what has this got to do with sustainability? How can players who connect with Call of Duty online be part of this recovery plan?
Yeah, that's a great question. So look, we were talking in the office about the launch of Call of Duty Vanguard. It's a great new game. And obviously we were calling it COD the whole time. And at the same time, almost serendipitously on the same day, we were talking about how we could help our audience make a meaningful impact in the real world as opposed to just in the virtual world. And so a plucky member of the team came up with the wonderful idea of COD for COD. And so what we do is, when people play a percentage of games on our platform, what we do is we take some of those proceeds, and then what we do is we're putting them towards donating them to the Sea Changers charity. So by playing COD, you can save some COD.
it's enough to do with a kind of a hopeful rewriting of the program, in which rather than actually using weapons and automatic rifles, etc., you're actually using fish to actually whack people over the head. Although that could be a whole new series, you know, kind of Python-esque aspect. Just a thought. Let's move back to Tom Pickerill again. I mean, in a sense, that's good news. I mean, were you surprised when that was put forward? Did you think, wow, you know, this is blue sky thinking of the nth degree?
Yeah, I was intrigued. I think it's a super idea, to raise awareness of a very important issue with the gaming community is fantastic. And providing some positive support to sea changes is fantastic as well. So it seems like a win-win from my perspective.
Mm. And Stakester, of course, connects over 70,000 gamers. So, Thomas, that's quite a sort of hefty audience to connect with, who may not perhaps otherwise have been aware of the seriousness of the fish cod and their sustainability issues.
Yeah, this is the great thing about it, Alex. I think, donating the money is obviously a big part of it, and that's incredibly helpful for the charity. But the biggest thing here for us is helping to raise awareness, because gamers are actually phenomenal. They are socially engaged and they do care about the environment, and being able to raise awareness to them through this campaign is really the greatest achievement we can get from it.
In terms of life cycles, Tom, as you demonstrated with the previous recovery plan, it doesn't presumably take that much to actually start resuming or restoring stocks as they were, but it's important to actually avoid the tipping point beyond which, of course, extinction events are likely to occur in the North Sea.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Female cod lay millions of eggs, and we've proven it before. If you remove or lower the amount of mortality that you've got on the population, then it can bounce back pretty quickly. That just needs to happen again. We've got to follow the science. It's world-class science, and it's there for a reason. So if that's followed, then we give the stock every chance to rebuild. And as you say, once it starts growing, it will grow quicker and get larger, and there's going to be healthy stocks and healthy fisheries.
And I've got to ask Tom Ferry, are you a cod consumer at all in terms of the actual fish?
This is a great question. I'm actually not a fish fan at all. So not at all.
On the other hand, it's good news for the fish, because there's one less carnivore to be worried about. So
I'd say that I'm a fan of the fish. I'm just not a fan of the flavour.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. And what about yourself, Tom? Because cod and chips, in so many ways, certainly in the East Coast, it's almost become a natural go-to dietary sustenance aspect.
Oh, absolutely. And I live in Lincoln myself, and we're very fortunate that we have some wonderful fish and chip shops serving up cod. So,
indeed.
Yeah, very, very happy.
Literally award-winning fish and chip shops in many ways. So great, great stuff on that side of things there. And you've got, of course, Skegness not too far away as well. So it's great stuff there. Thomas, where can people go to find out more details about how online players with respect to Call of Duty can actually help with this fantastic project?
Yeah, super easy. Just head to codforcod.org, and that's FOR. So codforcod.org, and everything's there for you.
And Tom, from your own perspective, if people want to find out more about the science behind the sustainability project, where would you point them?
Sea Changes is the charity that Stakester are working with, and they have a website that's easily Googled. But if you're interested in sort of the bigger picture about sustainable cod, there's a number of organisations such as the Marine Conservation Society, Seafish, for example, plus the Marine Stewardship Council. They've got loads of resources that can inform people.
And it's only fair, as we actually put to Tom Ferry the question about whether he ate cod, what about yourself and actually playing Call of Duty? Are you a Call of Duty secret player?
Oh, I am so bad. I'm still working on the World War II version, but I just get shot by everyone.
Yeah, I know the feeling. And that's just working in education. But what the hey, life continues. Tom Pickerill, marine biologist extraordinaire, and indeed Tom Ferry, the founder, chief executive officer, in fact, of Stakester. Huge thanks. And keep saving those cod, gentlemen.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Thank you.
yesterday. I'm sorry, ma'am. No fish today.
Don't expect me to rebel. This is not a fair.